Accession number 17970, Real One.
Squadron Leader Johnson, Real One. Where were you born, please?
In Horncastle in Lincolnshire.
Which year was this?
This was 1921, 5th of November, 25th of November.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Horncastle?
No. My schooling, basic schooling, was in Lord Wandle's College in Hampshire, Long Sutton, Hampshire.
Where were you living then?
I was a boarder there. We were living in Nottinghamshire, near Newark in Nottinghamshire.
So really, Newark is your hometown?
Yes.
How old were you when you finished your schooling there?
18.
1939?
Yes.
And did you go into a job, or...?
I went into parks training, park keepers training.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
I did, indeed.
Under what circumstances?
I was at school during the holiday, working during the holiday period, in fact.
And how did you feel about the news?
Well, distressed that we were, in fact, again at war, but not surprised in the light of Hitler's behaviour up to that time.
Were you in any early bombing of Britain by the German Air Force?
Only one minor occasion at Basingstoke.
Can you describe it, please?
Yes, I was in a hospital bed, in actual fact, having just recovering from a hernia operation. Saw with the aircraft flying over, and then the bombs dropping, and then the alarms went. And so it was a question of getting back into the hospital. We were lying out in the grounds at that stage, getting back into the hospital as quickly as possible. And the damage was not tremendous. Certainly nothing in the hospital in the immediate area.
Which hospital was this?
This was Basingstoke Hospital.
Do you remember where the bombs fell in Basingstoke?
Roughly... around the railway station area.
Which year was this?
This was 40, what, this would be 40, yes, early 40.
How frightening was that raid for you?
Well, basically, as I say, I was actually in bed. Outside in the grounds, having a recovery session outside, and I hadn't been out of bed since the operation, so I didn't know whether I could walk or not, and I just didn't know what to do, in fact, and I was very quickly persuaded to get out and run. I don't remember feeling particularly frightened. Then it was a long time ago, and I may quite well have been.
Was there any damage done to the railway station?
Not a lot, just a little. And not a lot of damage to the surrounding... It was only, as I recall, two aircraft. And not a lot of bomb load between them. Whether it was just offloading, leaving another raid or something of that nature, I would think perhaps it was.
Now, can you tell me about joining the RAF yourself?
Yes, I joined on 6th of November in 1940 and was accepted for pilot training. I had to wait for aircrew training and served that at 12 SFTS at Grantham on ground duties. And then in April 41 to the ACRC at Brabacon, and then to 790W at Newquay.
What did you think of this training that you were getting at this time?
It was new. It was strict, which didn't worry me too much. and certainly was, I think, a good preparation for service life.
Why had you volunteered for RAF aircrew in the first place?
Because that was the only thing I wanted to do. I wanted to fly, and I felt the need to do something towards the war.
What do you think had influenced you to want to fly?
Just personal feeling, I think.
And how did the training proceed from then?
To Arcadia in Florida for training under the American Army Air Force, which wasn't successful. And in that was July, from July 41 onwards. In January of 42, I returned to the United Kingdom via Maxwell Field, Alabama, and Moncton in New Brunswick. And because I had, to my mind, wasted so much time, I opted for the shortest aircrew training course, which was gunnery at that stage, and was trained as an air gunner at Morpeth and at Bridlington and Morpeth.
If we could just go back to Arcadia, Florida.
Yeah.
Can you give me some more details about what was happening to that, please?
Well, it was basic. It was basic flying training under the organization of the U.S. Army Air Corps. There were some differences of opinion between us and them about drill forms, about discipline generally. But that was a mere sideline. The failure was due to not being able to solo in the required time.
What was the required time?
12 hours.
What were these differences in emphasis about discipline?
We thought that theirs was very petty. For instance, in the barrack room situation, beds had to be made up to a certain specification, which included an exact 45 degree angle fold at the base of the blanket, and this was checked with a protractor by the inspecting officer.
So how did the RAF trainees react to that?
Well, they obviously they complied, because if they didn't, they got what was known as a gig. And if you collected, I can't remember how many it was now, I think it was five. If you collected five gigs in a week, you were given so many hours marching up and down out in the open on the, over the weekend. Which in the Florida temperature wasn't particularly pleasant.
Did you ever get that?
I did indeed, yes. On at least one occasion.
What were your five gigs for?
I honestly can't remember. I would have say offhand something equally, something particularly petty, at least I would feel was petty.
Was there any mutiny or formal complaint?
No, not really. We had occasional, we met occasionally with the asked the RAF contingents, who the RAF had training fields of their own in America at that time, and they of course were purely under RAF discipline and training and so on, and the comparison we felt was not very much in our favour. In fact, they were getting a much better deal than we were.
In what sense?
In as much as they were working with a service that they knew, with the disciplines that they knew, and this was particularly the problem, I think.
So what were relations like between the Americans and the British generally?
Tolerable, I think, would probably be the best answer to that. No better than that.
Did you have any contact with local civilians?
A little, yes, but not a lot. Certainly not at that at Arcadia, but when we moved to Alabama, yes, we had more contact with the civilians then. And they treated us extremely well.
What form did it take?
Invitation to weekends at their homes. That was the prime form.
What was the name of the training place in Alabama?
Maxwell Field.
What was the instruction like in America?
I think it was probably quite good. Basically civilian instructors.
Did the Americans have a different way of flying?
I was flying by the seat of your pants, man. That was the basic scheme.
Does that mean without using instruments?
Well, you had the instruments there, but you were sort of given to understand they weren't the be-all and end-all. Your feeling and your feeling with the aeroplane was the most important thing.
A more subjective approach?
Yes.
Did that suit the British?
No, generally, yes. I wouldn't for a minute blame them for my inability to qualify.
Did America come into the war whilst you were in America?
Yes. Not in America, but in Canada. When we came coming back, while I was waiting at Moncton, they came into the war at that stage. Pearl Harbor happened while we were at Moncton.
What do you remember about the reaction to that event at Pearl Harbor?
Well, of course, we didn't really have direct connection with the Americans at that stage, but certainly the Canadian reaction was one of complete surprise and shock, I suppose.
Did you run into the enemy in any way in the voyages to and from across the Atlantic?
No, only on the return journey. Bad sea conditions, rough storms. We came back on the southern route via the Azores and hit an Azores high, and that was rather uncomfortable for not only for us but for the crew of the ship as well.
Now, can you tell me what your training as an air gunner consisted of when you got back to England?
Yes, it was a return to ITW at Bridlington, and then to Maxwell, to Morpeth, the gunnery school at Morpeth, for theory, gunnery, signals training, some signals training, Morse training, and gunnery practice, ground and air, flying in Botha aircraft, which were not the best of things, not the best of aircraft, the Blackburn Botha. We were assured that it wouldn't fly on one engine, it was a twin engine, it wouldn't fly on one. And the particular turret, the mid-upper turret, was a peculiar conical shape, which was extremely difficult to get into and out of. So had there been any hazard and the question of getting out of the aircraft, it would have been extremely difficult to get out quickly. That wasn't very pleasant. But I suppose it was a thought one always had, well, what happens if one of these engines does go?
Were there any accidents in the event?
No.
What was the theory behind gunnery?
Well, it was basically the sighting and the aiming off when the pilot was taking evasive action when being attacked by fighters. question of range for opening up and so on, that sort of thing.
What kind of advice were you given about that?
Well, basically, I can't remember what the range of the 303 was, but it wasn't very, very good, but not particularly good anyway. And it was a question of sort of trying to wait until you've got an accurate line on your target before you open. And, of course, if he was already firing at you, responded as quickly as possible to try to offset his aim.
What was your actual what was the actual title of your job in the RAF then?
Air gunner, just at that stage.
Not a wireless operator?
No, no, just straight air gunner.
But you said you were learning signals.
Well, we had to do Morse as part of the ITW course. This went along with the same for pilot training. We had to do Morse at ITW.
What did you think of the weapons with which you were equipped in those days?
Well, in those days, one had it was the only weapons one had, and so really that was it. You had no choice at that stage. The 303 was the gun for the Browning 303 was the only gun that we had.
Did they operate efficiently?
Yes.
And reliably?
By and large, they did. Yes.
Did the Germans ever attempt to attack Morpeth or any of the other places you were training at?
No.
We're talking about 1942, are we?
Yes, we are now. Yes.
And anything else that happened to you at Morpeth?
No, I don't think so. That was just purely the training period. I can't remember exactly how long the period was, but not a particularly long period of training. Then posted to Director Squadron. I was posted to 97 Squadron at Woodhall as a spare gunner.
Is it called Woodhall Spa?
Woodhall Spa, yes.
When would this posting have been?
This was in August of 41.
42.
42, sorry, yes, 42.
What were they equipped with?
At that stage, they had just re-equipped with Lancasters.
What was it like being, from the comfort and work point of view, operating in a Lancaster as an air gunner?
Much better, for instance, than anything. I was operated basically as a mid-upper gunner. And the turret was much more accessible, much more comfortable, and obviously much easier to get into and out of.
And were you crewed up here?
No, not for the originally, not initially. I was, as a spare gunner, and flew with any crew that had a gunner off sick or whatever. Towards the end of my gunnery period, the flight commander gunner had finished, so I joined his crew for a couple of trips. But because the squadron had just re-equipped with Lancasters, they needed the additional crew member, the bomb aimer. And, of course, they weren't coming through from basic training at that stage. And so they organised a local bomb aimer's training course at Fulbeck, a group bomb aimer's training course. And I was selected to do that. And then came back and joined an NCO crew as the bomb aimer of that crew.
What was the method of work for a bomb airman?
Basically, assisting the navigator with whatever pinpoints he could pick up, if you could at that particular height. Manning the front turret when you weren't actually on making the bombing attack. And then, of course, leading the pilot into the target and dropping the bombs at the appropriate moment.
How were the bombs actually released?
Automatically from a distributor system. The distributor was set up, and the bombs were released by a pressing of the button, certainly at that stage. As indicated by the bomb sight, of course, and at that stage we were equipped with the Mark 14 bomb sight, which wasn't a bomb sight, but was the best we had at that time.
What did the Mark 14 bomb sight consist of?
Basically, as far as we were concerned, a sighting unit. It wasn't in any way stabilised, and the sighting unit gave you the illuminated cross, which you directed towards the target. You had on the what one would call the computer box, as far as that was concerned, set on the airspeed and height, as according to the aircraft was flying at, that was fed into this sighting system, and you directed the pilot to bring the line of the light dead onto the target. You did it as best you could, and at the moment of coincidence of the two, pressed the button and away went the bombs, released in stick form at a preset interval between each bomb.
What was this light?
It was the light in the illuminated cross in the sight in the bomb sight itself, through the reflector of the bomb sight.
What were the main problems of doing that job?
Basically, getting the aircraft into the right position at the right time. It was a question of corrections, and we used a standard form of corrections. Left, left, right, or steady, whichever the case may be. And then, at the end, bombs gone, when they had all been released. So that was the standard pattern throughout any aircrew bombing run.
What was the difference between saying left, left, or just left?
You couldn't say left. It was to make the positive distinction between left and right. Left, left. Was if you said left, it could have been confused as right, might have been. If you had the two words for left, then there was no confusion between them. And so left, left was always the standard form, and right for the starboard direction.
So obviously you would never say right, right.
No. If you did, you'd get killed.
And what could you see of the target as you were going over?
The lot. I suppose, as a bomb aimer, people often say to me, were you frightened? And I have to say yes. I think anybody that wasn't either isn't being particularly honest or had no feelings at all. You can imagine lying in the front of the aircraft and approaching the target, and you could see from some considerable range the sort of reception that you're going to get with the anti-aircraft fire that was coming up. And the realisation that you've got to fly into that. But once you got onto the bombing run, that just disappeared. You're concentrating on what you were doing, and you didn't notice what was going on around about you.
But when you say you could see the target, you mean you could see the markers on the
target? Oh, yes. Yes, you could see the markers. Markers came in, hadn't been properly established at the time I started operations, but they came in shortly after. And they were quite distinctive. As long as it was ground marking, you had a very definite aiming point. But there were times when the target was obscured by cloud. And so we had then a system of the Pathfinders used a system of aerial flares, which we bombed on. That was called, as I recall, a Parramatta attack. The accuracy of that was, I think, somewhat dubious.
Why was that?
Well, basically because you've got the point of release being at a particular point. Flares being released in the air and burning in the air were obviously drifting away as well. So, dependent on what time you attacked, it depended on how soon you would actually, how near your bombs would fall. They were, to some degree, parachuted so that they would stay reasonably stable, one hoped, but in fact they obviously drifted quite a lot. And I believe from the Pathfinder's point of view, it was a bit difficult to be absolutely accurate with the release of those flares.
And could you see anything of what was on the ground?
Not at that stage, no. If it was covered with cloud, the only thing you might see was a glow coming through it. Excuse me. From bombs, exploding bombs, and any fires that had been started. And, of course, if the anti-aircraft fire was coming through the clouds, then yes, you could see that.
But if there was no cloud, could you see?
Oh, yes, you could see quite clearly. You pick up the various buildings, the rivers, all the detail of the attack area.
Now, to go on to the particular raids that you were on,
mm-hmm.
Can you remember the first one?
Yes. The first one was abortive, in that we were halfway across the North Sea and we started losing fuel from one of the port engines. And it was... I was in the mid-upper turret, and probably the first to notice that and advise the captain, so that was we had to turn back. I suppose the first operational trip must have been one of the Ruhr targets. And they, of course, were more than heavily defended.